For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And this week, we're heading out into the wilderness to appreciate the beauty of the natural world. Catherine Raven introduces us to her contemplative scientific memoir, Fox and I. David Gange takes us kayaking down the frayed Atlantic edge of the British Isles. And Read On producer Hannah Tauss investigates the work of wildlife-inspired novelist Barbara Kingsolver. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Dr. Catherine Raven is a university professor and former US National Park ranger who lives off the grid in the wilderness of Montana. Fox and I is her memoir of how befriending a young male fox who visited her remote cabin helped her find purpose in life. Dr. Catherine Raven, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. The Fox and I is a story about my best friend, Wild Red Fox. And then I suppose if I tell you my best friend was a wild red fox, you probably realize that my only friend was a wild red fox. And that would be true. I was a person who didn't interact with humans very much and didn't talk very much, and certainly not about myself. And I was trying to get away to a city, use my PhD, meet people, fit into society, but this fox kept dogging me around. So this is the story of the trade-off between the fox and I fighting back and forth, I wanting not to get too close to him, and he determined to have a friend. And of course, in the end, he wins out, and I did become his friend. It's a tragedy also. It doesn't end well. You probably know most stories about wildlife don't end well. But it's a story about friendship and why it matters and how it's important and how to fit in to nature, to the world around us, not to look at it like it's something better than us or bigger than us, but that it is us, that we are really part of the wild natural world.
And this young fox began to come to your cabin, which is in a very remote part of Montana, at the same time every day. And this led you to question yourself as a scientist, as a trained biologist, as to whether you were seeing character in a wild animal and whether you were crossing scientific method boundaries.
That's right. That's a terrible decision to have to make. It wasn't only my scientific training, but I had been a park ranger with the National Park Service for a very long time prior to my PhD. And in the Park Service, as well as in the academy, we're trained not to anthropomorphize, which means to those institutions that animals that are not human do not have traits that we have saved and reserved for humans, that there are, as you said, character, personality, that only belongs to humans. And we're not allowed to pretend that non-human animals have those traits. So I had basically memorized this, internalized that this could not possibly be happening. So I had to finally let my own intuition, my own instincts start to come through. Because truth, you know, truth and knowledge doesn't only come from science. Well, science is so important. We need science to put men on the moon and to develop vaccines, but we don't need science for everything. It can't answer every question in the world. And one of the questions science can't answer is whether or not this fox had a personality.
And so you supplement the scientific graph paper approach for some lined paper and start recording your interactions with the fox. And one of the things you start off with is to begin games of show and tell with this young fox.
Yes, I realized doing show and tell with the fox that it allowed me to lose any of my inhibitions because I put my little trinkets, a little geode, some shell casings from a rifle, little bits of plant parts that I had on my wooden steps, and I faced the trinkets instead of looking at the fox. I looked at the trinkets, and I told little stories about them. And the fox, he looked at the little trinkets instead of looking at me. Both of us would have been shy. I was naturally shy, and he should have been shy of humans. It kept us facing the trinkets instead of ourselves originally. And I think that allowed us to really interact closely. And I realized that he liked the stimulation. And of course, he liked feathers. I always had feathers in my pockets. And he liked it when I pulled out feathers. He's a fox, so of course he wanted to sniff them. And the show and tell with all the little trinkets, the natural items that I had in my pockets, was a great way to start this relationship with the fox.
The book begins with you recording some of these early show and tell experiments and questioning yourself. Should you really be finding personality in this fox? Are you deluding yourself? And actually, we as readers are invited to question your reactions too. In some ways, you throw down the gauntlet to us at the beginning of the book. Has Catherine Raven started anthropomorphizing this fox? Has she turned him into a pet? And yet, after that initial challenge, we're invited to see that what you are doing is an experiment, and the fox demonstrates more and more personality and actually draws you out of yourself as well.
That's right. I start to accept more and more of his personality as I compare him with my observations of other animals and see how he's different. And I compare him with what I'm reading in the textbooks and see how he's different. And I start to look at him and see the aspects of his personality that I really enjoyed. He spent a lot of time on hobbies. He didn't spend all his time looking for a mate and eating and sleeping and hiding, the things that we think that wild animals in a harsh environment need to do. In fact, he spent a tremendous amount of time doing things that didn't seem to have a utilitarian purpose at all, just having fun, playing games. He liked to play hide the egg game with me. He liked to play the chicken game with me. He collected little trinkets and brought them up to his den, things that weren't edible, things that had no purpose really other than for decoration. And I noticed when he sat during certain times of the day, he was always very cognizant of where the sun was. When he was walking, he didn't want the sun in his eyes. But when he was resting and I was watching him, he liked to sunbathe. He liked the heat on his body, but not in his eyes. And when there was a fascinating scene, like an amazing sunset over the mountains, he faced that way. So he did have a sense of beauty in the world, I think, and of aesthetics and of fun and of relaxing. And I realized he spent more time on hobbies than I did. And he seemed to have a better quality of life than I did. So that certainly gave me pause.
Yes, he definitely seems to have discovered leisure. And it's important to say that at no time are we talking about a tame animal here. He was just fun-loving and playful. And we see him against a background of an entire community of animals in the area surrounding the cabin that you have built. You, by building a cabin in the wilderness, have disrupted an environment, and that environment is reforming around you. So you're observing the behavior of other animals, such as magpies and voles, which has also altered to accommodate your presence.
Well, you put it really nicely. I love the way you said that. I did just push in to a new environment, and I caused it to break up, and then it had to reform around me. That is something that natural systems aren't thrilled about doing. It's not a normal thing to seek change when things already seem to be going well. But things had to change to accommodate me because I pushed in here. And the ants and the birds, the magpies especially, they seem to really not like my existence here. And they were quite put out. It's a fairly large structure for a magpie. For a person, it's just a teeny, teeny, tiny little hobbit hole. But for a magpie, my house must have seemed enormous. And this big steel roof, a blue steel roof, they didn't want it here. And they thump on it, boom, 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 all the time, for no apparent reason, except to annoy me.
We get to see through the magpies that other animals apart from fox do react to your presence. The magpies are sulky, especially when you take away the eggshells and they can't slurp up the eggs and bring them to their chicks. And it's not just the fox who is exhibiting human-type behaviour when this big biped comes in and starts to disrupt their environment.
That's right. And finally, I thought to myself, you know, I teach genetics as part of my ecology classes to my students, and I realized how much of our DNA is identical to a chimp, and the little parts that are different have to account for things like size and body hair and skull and skeletons. And when you figure out all of the things that we can see that are different, there really isn't enough DNA differences for us to make out that it's reasonable to assume that humans are hugely far away from all other animals, that we sit way, 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 way over here and all the other animals are someplace else. It just doesn't make any sense to assume that. I think that I came to realize that even though I started with my gut instinct, logically, it makes sense to believe that some of the things that we think are human, the desire for leisure, to play, wanting to matter in this world, wanting to leave a legacy, those can't possibly be traits that only humans have. Those must be traits that we share with some other animals as well.
Yes, it is the question that is, I suppose, at the heart of this book. Why do we want to separate ourselves so much from our fellow animals? Why do we feel the need to draw lines when patently we are similar? You point out that one of the big kicks that humans get coming on your nature expeditions that you lead is being up close and personal with animals killing each other. It's clearly something bestial in us. And also, what's so bad about anthropomorphizing animals? Because as you point out, that's exactly what we do when we have pets.
Yes, that's right. We are allowed to anthropomorphize pets, but not wild animals. And I think when you pointed out the bestiality in us, I think that's part of the root of the problem. You ask, why do we separate ourselves? And I ask why also. And I wonder if it isn't partially not so much because we're afraid of pretending like animals are like humans, but I think we're afraid of admitting that humans are like other animals. And you talk about the pornography of violence. We don't want to believe that we're afraid that we're similar to other animals in terms of maybe our sexual appetites, our appetite towards violence. We want to think that we are so much different than animals. But in fact, as you said in the beginning, we are part of the animal kingdom. People forget that all the time. Even my students, I have to remind them constantly, even second year students keep forgetting that humans are animals.
And this is very much where the title of the book comes from. Fox and I is the telltale phrase that your brighter students pick up on and they start to suspect. Yeah. That you're getting too close to this fox.
Yes, they did pick up on that, and they suspected that something was wrong. Nobody should be talking about the fox and I so often as though someone would say, my girlfriend and I, or my boyfriend and I, or Rover and I, Rover being your dog. That's okay. But starting to say fox and I, it seems to indicate that I'm doing something wrong, that I have broken a taboo, that I've crossed the line that society has established, humans on one side and wildlife on the other. And we're not supposed to cross that line, but I did cross the line to my betterment. It made me a better person in that I solved a lot of the problems that I had. All the time I was worried about where I should live and how I should live. And by becoming part of the Fox and I started watching him just as you would a spouse or close friend. You start to model, you start to mimic, you start to admire. But I had all of those feelings toward him, the Fox. And I realized that why I felt he had a better life than I did was that he was living in his optimal habitat and he had habits, the things that he did that he chose. And that was what his life was about, habit and habitat. It wasn't about a career or a profession or trying to put himself into some culture's idea of what you need to be doing at this point in time in your life. You need to be a professor, you need to be a scientist, you need to be a researcher. He had a habitat first. And I decided I needed to pick my habitat first. Where do I want to live? Am I a city mouse or am I a country mouse? And I'm a country mouse, not a city mouse. Put myself where I want to live first, the kind of place. Some people are ocean people, some people are inland people. Find your place. That's what all the other animals do, except humans. We're supposed to find a career first, and then we follow the career to wherever it wants to drop us off. Instead, all the other animals and Fox, he found his habitat first. He spent a lot of time picking the optimal habitat. He could walk straight up the hill and live in a colder place, or he could go down to the valley and live in a warmer place on the river. He chose this place, his optimal habitat. He liked all the voles here. And then you choose the things that you want to do, your hobbies. I call them the verbs, not the nouns, not I'm going to be a professor. But if what you like is teaching and writing, then that's what you focus on. You don't have to be a professor to teach and write. So people should focus on their verbs, not on the noun. That's what I learned from Fox, habit and habitat.
You illustrate this beautifully, not just by your observation of the habitat around you and your realization that owning that land makes you responsible for that community, but you also illustrate it by your love of literature and the fellowship that you have found with other authors such as Herman Melville in Moby Dick, and also the author of The Little Prince, which is a very important book to you.
Very much. Books are very much a part of my life. And I think for people that live by themselves, not a lonely person, because I'm not lonely since I realize I'm part of nature, but books allow me to have associations with people who live at different times and different places than I do. And the narrator of Moby Dick, Ishmael, I really empathize with him so much to this day and for decades. I really understand that particular narrator, even though he's fictional. And that book was written in the 1800s. So we live not in the same time and not even in the same place, because he was, you know, on the Nantucket coast, on the Atlantic coast of the United States. So books allow me and other people, I suppose, to get close to people who live in different times and places. And I think that's very important, because sometimes the people around us are very different than us. And we want to find a connection with people that might not be physically with us at the time. And I think that's really the importance of literature, is to allow that connection.
You mentioned the narrator of Moby Dick, and you have got the most wonderful narrator for the audiobook version of Fox and I in Stacey Glembowski.
It was very important to me that she didn't sound like, when she was doing Fox's voice or sections of the book in general, like God, like the voice of nature, because people tend to do that. That's a very typical kind of nature book, where people tend to believe that nature is the same thing as God, And therefore, you have to have this godlike voice, this voice of power and all importance and awe speaking down to you. And of course, as you've mentioned, that's not what the book is about. The book is, we are nature. We're part of it. And so it's not something to be afraid of. And I think that she was able to carry that off. She had the voice that I really liked that wouldn't put people off.
Having slept since mid-morning in the shade of his favorite boulder, the fox woke to the heat of a sinking sun. Pointing his butt skyward and his nose windward, he stretched his neck along a foreleg that was naked as a newborn mouse. The fur wasn't actually gone, just misdirected. Turning tailward, he discovered his fur blowing flat back, leaving the hide on the front of his legs exposed, but warm. A mouse was scraping through the gravelly soil with footsteps as heavy and hesitant as a pregnant female's. The mouse was almost close enough when a wind whip cracked the dried grasses and wiped out the soundtrack. Weasel pee! And his day was just starting.
Stacey Glembowski, narrating Fox and I, written by my guest, Catherine Raven.
Now, one thing that blind listeners will not be able to appreciate is the beautiful photographs that are in the book and the cover. Would you just like to describe those for us?
Foxes are different colors. We call them red foxes, but they do come, of course, in different colors. And he wasn't a bright red fox. He was more blondish and grayish. But all red foxes have a white tip on their tail and black legs, black like knee stockings. So he liked to sit with that big brush curled around him, so almost like in a little ball and putting his nose down. He also, there's pictures of him opening his mouth, and when he opens it, it looks like he's a tiny little animal, maybe 6 pounds at the most, opens up wide enough to put my head in. When the fox faced me up close from my arm's length away, he put his nose down so that his nose wasn't in the way. By putting his nose down, we were eye to eye, and our eyes are about the same width apart. That's very interesting. We were actually able to look eye to eye. I was sitting, and he was propped up, so our heads were the same height above the ground, and our eyes were the same width. So very interesting. So we were able to look eye to eye. That's something important about a fox and a human.
It is the most wonderfully poignant, moving and thoughtful book. And I think the line that I took away from this more than any other was, those of us who have barnacled ourselves to inhospitable places, maybe trying to avoid people, not because we do not like people, but because we like the things that people have destroyed. And for me, it really was a pause for thought. We should listen more to the nature around us and respect our places in it, and to realize that we have stewardship of the earth around us. Is that the message that you most want us to take away?
I love that message. I love that line in the book. Is really very important to me. A message not to think that country people are odd people or misanthropes at all, just people that love nature. And I think, yes, that it benefits all of us to be a little bit more gentle, fit ourselves into nature. We will feel less lonely and a lot happier because it's the community that we're born into. I mean, no matter where you're born, no matter what you think your identity is, you are definitely part of the natural community. There's 100 other communities you can say that you're part of, but every single person is part of the natural community, and we need to take our place in that community and treat it like we are a member, which means responsibility, and then take the benefits with the responsibility.
Well, I think that's a wonderful message with which to finish the interview. Dr. Catherine Raven, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Fox and I, and for being a guest on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome, and bye-bye, everybody.
Fox and I is out now in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books, and Catherine Raven will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, producer Hannah explores the rich tapestry of wildlife that lies at the heart of Barbara Kingsolver's novels. But first, here's a reminder that the wilderness can be coastal as well as inland. A new addition to the RNIB library is The Frayed Atlantic Edge by historian and nature writer David Gange. The book charts his year-long exploration of the Atlantic coasts of Britain and Ireland. Sitting at sea level in his kayak, he had the same perspective as those who for thousands of years lived and traded in these areas. He set out to understand their history and to see what it meant for our future. But he joined me on dry land at the Camden Studios to tell me all about it. David Gange, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me, hello.
Now, you're a cultural historian, and there's a lovely thing that you say at the beginning of the book. You're resetting the balance of the geographical diversity of history of Britain, which is what really led you to the western coast of Britain, the Atlantic coast.
Yes, absolutely. So it was only really in the 19th century that the middle of Britain and the middle of Ireland, where the kind of big roads and rail links go, became the centres. Until that point, lots of trade, lots of travel, lots of culture had happened along the coastlines instead. And I wanted to come up with a way of viewing Britain that turned things that way. And I realised if I was to kayak down all of the coastlines from Shetland down to the Channel that were Atlantic, I'd be giving a version of Britain where, for most of the journey, English is the second language, where I could travel for five whole months of the year, passing only one town of more than 600 people, and where, as you say, I could just look back into how the geography of the islands looked before that Industrial Revolution turnaround happened.
Yeah, we are very much a post-Industrial Revolution society where history is urban, and we've forgotten the trading links that we had with Western Europe and Scandinavia and the Iberian Peninsula. We look inwards rather than outwards now.
Yes, absolutely. So there are sites in Ireland, for instance, where if you look through the archaeology of the coastal site, you find lots and lots of evidence of links with China for centuries before you find a single bit of evidence for a link with London, which is quite extraordinary.
And you found a very rich set of archives of that local history as you were travelling along and in your research beforehand. These aren't dead cultures, although they might appear to be so from some of the more recent history.
Absolutely, that is completely the case. So between about 1800 and about 1970, most technological developments worked against these places, made them marginal, made them more difficult to get to, more difficult to work from. But since the 1970s, all the technological developments to do with the internet and things have kind of made life easier, have relinked those places into bigger networks and have created a huge revival. So there's lots and lots of interest in the history of these regions, lots of spectacular archives. I mean, the archive for Shetland, for instance, which has a population of about 20,000, is far better staffed, far better organised than the archive for the whole of Birmingham. It's quite astonishing.
And they are so interlinked. I hadn't really appreciated how linked Shetland was to the other coastal trading settlements, stretching for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles.
Yes, partly because of unpredictabilities of sea travel. If you try and head round Cape Wrath in the northwest of Scotland in a small boat to get to the Western Isles like Lewis and Harris, there's a reasonably high chance you'll be blown off course and end up in Orkney or Shetland. So yeah, the interchange was constant. The interchange is constant again now. We just have that kind of dark age, the 19th and 20th centuries, when it wasn't.
I love the fact that those are the dark ages, whereas actually the dark ages that we learn about at school are actually a very vibrant time.
Completely. That's the thing about seeing the British and Irish islands from that perspective, is you have to overturn all those narratives. The Enlightenment was a total disaster for these regions, whereas, like you say, they had their enlightenment several centuries before, in what were the Dark Ages for much of Europe.
Now, clearly it was very important for you to explore every inch of this very dramatic frayed coastline in the same way as those traders did for hundreds and maybe thousands of years. It was also extremely dangerous at times. You were in an 18-foot kayak for most of the time?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember with this is that this kind of feels like an adventure, crossing these bits of rough sea in a little boat. But these are things that every family on these coastlines, every family with their own boat, used to do all the time. And it's another indication of how things have been turned around, that this thing that would have seemed totally alien and impossible to them, that we can communicate with people on the other side of the globe in an instant, seems totally ordinary to us, yet something that was completely ordinary to all of them, crossing these bits of sea, is now alien and feels like an adventure to us. So the little boat is a way of being able to empathise with those people in the past, being able to understand the world from their perspective.
And I was fascinated, actually, to find out that your kayak, yes, it might be made out of more modern materials, but actually it is pretty much the same kind of design as would have been used maybe 2,000 years ago.
In terms of its shape and things like that, then very much there's a long, long tradition of these kayaks and small boats, lots of traditions of them all around the Atlantic.
Now, for anybody who hasn't read the book already, and I do urge them to, I am absolutely hooked. What were some of the scarier moments?
So I almost gave up on the first day. I was coming out of the north of Shetland to this tiny little rock, which is the northernmost part of the British Isles, called Outstack. And it was a beautiful, sunny, calm day. Couldn't have been any better. I thought it wasn't going to be all that momentous. Kayaked up the Firth. Suddenly had hundreds of thousands of gannets circling overhead, to the point where I couldn't hear the sea anymore. And hearing is possibly the most important navigational thing for a kayaker. You're listening to where the waves are breaking ahead of you. That's how you know where there is a reef or something like that, and you're listening for these corridors of silence that you can pursue, because that's where safety lies. So all these gannets overhead, making me feel a bit perturbed anyway, and then I hit this huge wall of tides, just waves pushing the bow of the kayak under the water until it kind of surged up from its buoyancy, just beating me around, and I had to roll the kayak. I was knocked underwater by waves twice, and just felt, within about an hour of setting off, like I'd been through a huge washing machine, and stopped on a little bay, in a little island, a little bay, and had to think very, very hard about whether I'd taken off, like bitten off more than I could chew, whether this was the end of my journey. Then there was a point later on where I'd sat in my kayak watching minke whales for a while, and I'd been noticing how their habit was to rise two or three times to breathe and then plunge down for 5 minutes. And I'd seen that the distance between one rise and the next was about 40 feet. And then out the corner of my eye, I saw a fin rise 40 feet behind me and realised that it was going to rise exactly where my kayak was if it followed the pattern I'd been watching. So I held onto my paddle with one hand, realising if it did rise underneath me, there was nothing I could do, paddle in hand or not. I picked up my camera with the other and it rose about 6 feet to my right. And I got one picture of the fin over the top of the water and then just was sloshed sideways by all the water that had come off its back and had to just brace myself against the sea to stay upright and didn't drop the camera to the bottom of the Atlantic.
You mentioned that there are beautiful photos, lovely maps, and rather a stunning dust jacket, I understand. Could you describe some of the more visually beautiful aspects?
Okay, so one of my favourite things in the book is a little section break, just between the different sections of the book, there is a beautiful little sea fan, which is a kind of seaweed that someone I got in touch with up in Glasgow made for me. She presses seaweeds and makes art from them. So she made me this wonderful sea fan for between the sections. Then, yes, there are 12 maps, one for each of the sections of the journey. So Shetland, Orkney, the Western Isles, with the route marked carefully on them. And the map maker has been careful to show those kind of ragged, what we call fractals of the coastline that make it such a long coastline, even though the British Isles are so small. And then, yeah, the dust jacket shows lots of rough sea hitting what is probably a little island, with the title of the book written in a large beach in the middle of the page, with lighthouses, there's a dolphin rising above the water, and lots of slightly stylized waves hitting rocks on the spine. And the one thing I asked for in particular There's a little yellow kayak on the back showing me passing down the island.
And the visual beauty is more than matched by the linguistic beauty of your writing. It's a huge celebration of the Celtic languages and of the rich folkloric history that populates the Atlantic coasts. You have taught yourself a lot of those languages so that you'd be able to understand them better, haven't you?
So it's very kind of you to say all those things. My linguistic ability is very limited. I've been trying to learn Welsh for about 10 years, slowly moving along. Learning Gaelic better is my summer project this year. I'm not by any means a speaker of those languages, although I am incredibly interested in them, partly because they contain kinds of knowledge and kinds of wisdom that have been set in opposition to kind of urban, economically acquisitive culture for the last two centuries. And at the point now where people in English-speaking cities are beginning to realise how urgently we need to change some of our attitudes to the world, those slightly oppositional languages and cultures, they're an amazing resource for finding attitudes and outlooks on the world that fit better with the kind of ecological problems that we face today.
And it is absolutely beautifully read by Ed Hughes. And I was talking to the guys in the Talking Books studios earlier today because it was recorded here.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And I think both your publisher and presumably you went to great lengths to get somebody who would be able to get their tongue round all those wonderful words from so many different cultures.
Yes, and what a challenge that must have been for Ed. He was absolutely heroic to take it on, because there's so much poetry in there in things like the Shetland dialect, which is a profoundly rich language. I think of it as a language rather than a dialect, and I think the difference we draw between a language and a dialect is a political choice, not a technical one. And to find someone who was willing to read those dialect poems, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Well, I think he was reveling in it just as much as you were writing it, I think.
That's fantastic.
And there's a rather beautiful dedication at the beginning of the book. You were inspired to take to the sea in a kayak and investigate Gaelic languages more by somebody who's been very special in your life.
Indeed, yes. So my partner through all of the book was Llinos Owen, who is a first language Welsh speaker and who had a car accident back in 2009. Which has left her unable to walk very much. She was in a wheelchair for a year, and her left leg, yeah, limits her walking each day. So the two of us took up kayaking together in 2010, and strangely, I've ended up kind of devoting a big part of my life to projects like this in the kayak, and she is now training with Team GB Paralympic kayak squad. So it turned out to be a far more momentous choice than we realised at the time when we bought our first little inflatable kayak in 2010.
And you didn't choose the easy way of doing this journey, which would have been to have gone from south to north and allowed the current to help you. You actually were going in the face of the current. Why?
Yeah, so it's the prevailing wind from the southwest that makes heading south to north so much more straightforward. Fortunately, it was the year of all of the last decade when those prevailing winds have been weakest and around least, so it didn't disadvantage me much. But it was really important to me to throw myself into the parts of the British Isles that are most different, the parts that are least well known right at the beginning, to head to Shetland and Orkney, to some really exciting kayaking and to some really, really profoundly distinctive cultures to begin with.
And had you just done the whistle stop tour, it would have been a lot shorter journey. How many miles extra did you add by investigating every inlet and cove and nook and cranny of the frayed Atlantic edge?
I think I added somewhere between about 800 and 1,000 miles by doing that.
What was your favourite moment on the entire trip?
That's a really difficult one. My favourite moments on the whole journey were often when the worst weather hit. And people imagine that when a storm hits and I'm doing one of these journeys, I'm there clinging to a rock or something. And in fact, that's never the case. I'm always drinking gallons and gallons of tea, someone on an island, like in their kitchen. So being stuck on somewhere like Bardsey Island through a week of storms, drinking tea with wonderful island people, often poets, and learning lots and lots of island histories in ways that could never happen otherwise. They were my absolute favourite moments, I think.
And I think that actually is the thing that really comes through the book. It is a real celebration of what we have in common as people, rather than the differences. And the welcome that you seem to have received along the entire Atlantic coast of Britain and Ireland was unquestioning.
It was, strangely, given that I was out at sea in a little boat on my own for most of the year, it was the most social year I have ever had. And the generosity of people in the island places I passed through, particularly in Scotland and Ireland, was really quite unexpected to me. I thought people might consider me an intruder or someone just popping through who didn't really belong there. But no, the welcome was absolutely extraordinary. And I hope the book is a tribute to the people who live on those coastlines and the generosity of the cultures that they have.
Are you tempted to get back out onto the waves again?
I get serious withdrawal symptoms whenever I don't. So I'm just back from 10 days in Shetland. I chose to launch the book in Shetland, partly because the people there had been so generous in helping me put everything together, partly because there are so many wonderful poets and musicians there that we could just have a really, really fun literary launch together. So I took the kayak out several days up there, took one of the poets out for a day as well on what was a surprisingly rough sea. And yes, I've got lots of kayak plans for future projects.
David Gange, thank you so much.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Red.
This journey involved arriving, dripping and bedraggled in dozens of coastal communities. When I set out, I hadn't imagined just how generous the people whose homes and workplaces I dampened would be. Without such openness, particularly evident on small islands, this project would never have got far. I learned as much through long evenings of discussion as through the other three resources on which the book is based: libraries, archives, and the observation of land and sea from the kayak. It wasn't just the spectacles of sea cliffs, nor the dramas of ocean weather, but also those social occasions that meant I ended the journey with greatly intensified enthusiasm for scattered Atlantic islands like Fula, Barra, and Tory. Such conversations worked to strengthen the conviction I set out with, that British and Irish histories are usually written inside out, perpetuating the misconception that today's land-bound geographies have existed forever.
The Frayed Atlantic Edge is available now from the RNIB Library as TB704421. It's narrated by Ed Hughes. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Catherine Raven for the books of her life, here's producer Hannah Taus with a review of another author for whom the natural world plays a central role.
When Red and I first discussed doing a Call of the Wild type of episode, the first novelist that sprung into my head, apart from Jack London, of course, was Barbara Kingsolver. I am strictly a city girl, but Kingsolver has the ability to make me long for nature, and leaves me with a desire to become more knowledgeable on zoology, botany, and the natural sciences. Fortunately, the RNIB Library has a number of her books to get your teeth into. The first of her novels, The Poisonwood Bible, tells the story of a missionary, Nathan Price, who brings his wife and four daughters from the US to a village in the Belgian Congo, hoping to convert the locals. Inevitably, they are vastly unprepared for what awaits them. The family are convinced of their superiority coming from the West, believing they can shape the land and the people to their will. When Nathan plants a garden with North American vegetables, it's not long before he discovers that they are completely inappropriate to the environment and fail to grow. Soon after, their live-in helper deserts them, furious that Nathan insists on baptizing the villagers in a crocodile-infested river, and this marks the beginning of the realization that perhaps their self-confidence is misplaced. But while the women begin to adapt to their surroundings, Nathan remains steadfast in his belief that the world should adapt to him, causing even greater resentment in the village. Thus begins a slow descent into hell. The story is told by the five women of the family, and nature suffuses every part of it, from the eponymous poisonwood tree to the pet parrot Methuselah.
Every day, Mama said, "You're going to crack your head wide open." But no, sir, I broke my arm instead. How I did it was spying on the African Communist Boy Scouts. Way up there in the tree I could see them, but they couldn't see me. The tree had green alligator pears that taste like nothing much. Not a one of us but Mama will eat them, and the only reason is she can remember how they tasted back home from the Piggly Wiggly with salt and Hellman's mayonnaise.
Liza Ross, narrating The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver.
Ultimately, the environment dictates every aspect of life until man destroys what he cannot adjust to. It's a heartbreaking but strangely uplifting book, and one that left me mourning its end. Returning back to the US, Prodigal Summer is set in rural Virginia, in the Appalachian Mountains, where Deanna, a park ranger, watches a den of coyotes, happy in her solitary existence until a young hunter disrupts her life. At the same time, Lusa, a farmer's wife, is forced to confront her attachment to the land she has found herself in, while two elderly neighbours feud over pesticides and pretty much anything else they can find to disagree on. Yet again, it's nature that links all these characters, and Kingsolver manages to show off her incredible knowledge of the interaction between humans and their environment.
Eventually, the animal would give itself away with a mound of scat, which might have dissolved in the rain too, or something else, some sign particular to its species. A bear will leave claw marks on trees and even bite the bark sometimes, though this was no bear. It was the size of a German shepherd, but no house pet either. The dog that had laid this trail, if dog it was, would have to be a wild and hungry one to be out in such a rain.
Barbara Kingsolver, narrating her novel Prodigal Summer, which is available commercially.
Flight behaviour yet again returns to Appalachia, where a young and unhappy housewife, Dell, finds millions of monarch butterflies in the valley behind her home. Originally tempted to run away with a younger lover and abandon her husband and two children, she sees this event as a good omen and changes course. However, the discovery soon brings an interest from outside, and she's quickly introduced to Professor Ovid Byron, who explains that this scene of beauty is actually a sign of global warming and that the monarchs should be in Mexico rather than Tennessee. It's not long before self-interest starts to rear its ugly head. Some property owners hope to make a quick buck by leading visitors. Others hope that the butterflies will leave so they can sell the lumber on the land, and eco-warriors jump on the bandwagon to spread their own message. The link between the story of the butterflies and that of Dell is what happens when you aren't where you should be.
On shearing day, the weather turned cool and fine. On the strength of that and nothing more, just a few degrees of temperature, the gray clouds scurried away to parts unknown like a fleet of barn cats. The chore of turning 90 ewes and their uncountable half-grown lambs through the shearing stall became a day's good work instead of the misery expected by all.
Barbara Kingsolver, narrating her novel Flight Behaviour.
Environmental and social justice are once again the themes that pervade this book, and it's hardly surprising given Kingsolver's background. Although she originally started studying music at university, she changed her major to biology and then went on to do a master's in ecology and evolutionary biology. Her passion for the environment soaks into the page, yet never becomes laboured or boring. Instead, it creates a longing to understand and interact better with the natural world around us, written not just as a diatribe to give up all modern luxuries, but a pragmatic understanding that man and nature are not always compatible. To find a full list of books written by Barbara Kingsolver, go to the RNIB Talking Books Library at www.rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Hannah. Now it's back to Catherine Raven for the books of her life.
So, Catherine, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, your English author J.R.R. Tolkien and The Hobbit was absolutely the most amazing book in the world. I still remember the cover of the book that I was given by the librarian in first grade, and it was white and black and green, a hardback book, and it was a very large book for a little tiny first grader, and I fell right into that book. The landscape, the community is just completely step into. It's an entire world that just takes you out of reality and puts you in this amazing place. I loved the landscape. I loved the escape. He's one of the few authors that can really get away with describing weather, for example, and still keep you enthralled. And he has that amazing third-person voice that I still hear in my head. Even today, very few people can pull off writing third person like J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm so thankful that he took the time to write that book. Certainly a labor of love for him.
By some curious chance, one morning long ago in the quiet of the world, when there was less noise and more green, and the hobbits were still numerous and prosperous, and Bilbo Baggins was standing at his door after breakfast, smoking an enormous long wooden pipe that reached down nearly to his woolly toes, neatly brushed, Gandalf came by. Gandalf. If you had heard only a quarter of what I have heard about him, and I've only heard very little of all there is to hear, you would be prepared for any sort of remarkable tale. Tales and adventures sprouted up all over the place wherever he went, in the most extraordinary fashion. He had not been down that way under the hill for ages and ages, not since his friend the old Took died, in fact, and the hobbits had almost forgotten what he looked like. He had been away over the hill and across the water on businesses of his own since they were all small hobbit boys and hobbit girls.
Andy Serkis narrating The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is available from the R&IB Talking Books Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I hate rain, and Fox hates rain too. And for your readers who might not have read the book yet and don't know much about Montana, the way it rains here is the drops, they're really far apart. And it's slow and far apart, so only animals that are really large and slow-moving actually get wet. Nevertheless, I hate rain. So on a rainy day, I have to have something funny to read. And the one author that I really like a lot, and his books are all over my house, actually, Bill Bryson, he is an expat. So he's an American. He's living somewhere in the UK, and he's very much into scenery and place, but he makes me laugh and learn. And I am an Anglophile, even though I'm not English at all. And I have Notes from a Small Island and A Short History of Nearly Everything. But the one book that has been on my coffee table for the past 2 years, and that's the one that I pick up in the rain, is Bill Bryson's At Home, A Short History of Private Life, which is much more than a history of private life. And that is the rainy day book.
Sometime after we moved into a former Church of England rectory in a village of tranquil anonymity in Norfolk, I had occasion to go up into the attic to look for the source of a slow but mysterious drip. As there are no stairs to the attic in our house, the process involved a tall stepladder and much unseemly wriggling through a ceiling hatch, which was why I had not been up there before, or have returned with any enthusiasm since. When I did finally flop into the dusty gloom and clambered to my feet, I was surprised to find a secret door, not visible from anywhere outside the house, in an external wall.
Bill Bryson narrating At Home, A Short History of Private Life, which, along with a wide range of his other titles, is available from the R&IB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
The French author Muriel Barbery wrote The Elegance of the Hedgehog. It's a novel, and the hedgehog isn't a fox, actually. She's referring to Tolstoy. And I love the story. The theme is the family that you create yourself. You can tell from the fox and I, and also actually the novel I'm working on now, the same theme, that we don't have to have the family that we were born into. We can choose our own family as we go through life. And the folks in this book, the main character, She's a concierge, actually, at an apartment for wealthy Parisians. And she's old and odd and kind of ignored and disrespected and poor and overweight. And despite that, she's an autodidact and brilliant. But nobody thinks she would be a genius or brilliant or a Tolstoy fan because they think anybody who's poor and fat and old must be just boring. And she becomes very good friends with a very well-educated, retired Japanese man who's just moved to France. And he's a retired Japanese scholar. And then a little girl in the building who's from one of the rich Parisian families. And she is also a brilliant and lovely child, but she's suicidal. And the three of them become very close friends. I love that book. And I recommend it. I'm on the Gifted Children's Program for the Mensa in my area, and I recommend that not just for adults, but for kids as well, because I love that theme that you choose your family and that the identity that you have, you see, they didn't identify themselves as Japanese and English or rich or poor. They identified themselves as Tolstoy scholars. That was their identity, and that's what brought them together, their love of Leo Tolstoy.
If you want to understand my family, all you have to do is look at the cats. Our two cats are fat windbags who eat designer cat food and have no interesting interaction with human beings. They drag themselves from one sofa to the next and leave their fur everywhere. And no one seems to have grasped that they have no affection for any of us. The only purpose of cats is that they constitute mobile decorative objects, a concept which I find intellectually interesting. But unfortunately, our cats have such drooping bellies that this does not apply to them. My mother, who has read all of Balzac and quotes Flaubert at every dinner, is living proof every day of how education is a raging fraud. All you need to do is watch her with the cats. She's vaguely aware of their decorative potential, and yet she insists on talking to them as if they were people, which she would never do with a lamp or an Etruscan statue.
Becky Wright narrating The Elegance of the Hedgehog by Muriel Barbary, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Catherine Raven, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
You are so very welcome, and I loved your questions, and thank you. You're just amazing. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can listen to us anytime by subscribing to your favourite podcast provider. Simply search for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to all my guests, to producer Hannah, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.